Hello and welcome to Pain in the Dice, where games are fun, but sometimes hard. Terry, what are we talking about today?
Today we are discussing Adversaries of the Righteous in our ongoing series of Book Talk, which is a way for us to talk about books that basically aren't Mage the Ascension. Chaz, what is Adversaries of the Righteous?
Adversaries of the Righteous is the companion book to 100 Devil's Night Parade, the previous Exalted book we read. It is a second book of Exalted antagonists focused more on full characters than monsters. So each of the individuals presented here has more of a personality, and the stats are a full character sheet rather than the quick character sheet that appeared in 100 Devil's Night Parade. Like its companion book, it was originally released in a series of one-off PDFs to get more out there for Exalted during Exalted's publishing lull. And this is the collected volume of all of those entries, along with a bunch of other stuff that didn't get published individually.
Yeah, and it is broken down into chapters kind of based on entity type, kind of like 100 Devil's Night Parade. And it goes through mortals, strange folk, which is what they consider to be things that don't fit into any other category, which they then go on to neatly categorize, spirits and the dead, the exalted, and the chapter I didn't know I needed in my life, groups.
I am not surprised that the groups chapter was your favorite. I think I said it would be at some point.
Spoiling the chapter, it did a lot to bring the setting together. The list of questions I asked to Chaz that would probably all be answered by this chapter and reading The Realm. So I got that half, and now I need to go back and read The Realm, which I will do. I kind of promise.
It is a good book.
So chapter one is entitled Mortals, and it's about mortals. But invariably, it's mortals that kind of have a special thing going on. And I guess to do things slightly out of order, I would like to note that I do like the cover art for this book. It does a reasonably good job of making you go, huh, there could be interesting stuff in this book, as opposed to 100 Devil's Night Parade, where you're like, yep, that's an exploding bear and that guy has a flute. This is going to be weird. We see a giant person inside what appears to be a frog mech. Because sometimes art doesn't work the way we want it to, that person appears to be flanked on their left by a 75-foot tall woman on a 100-foot tall horse. And then you remember that perspective is hard. Did you have any thoughts on the cover art, or I guess the introduction? Prelude?
But yeah, I like the cover generally. It feels very exalted. I think the frog mech is too small for what it is supposed to be as a war strider, but otherwise looks cool, fits the aesthetic.
Are there like mini striders in the game? Like, is there anything between the armor that mortals can wield if they spend 5 willpower and a proper like war strider?
Not specifically. I think it could fall into either the war strider or armor category. It's just an awkward size range. I'd probably want to model it after Gunzosha armor rather than a war strider in that scale, because it, to me, does not achieve legendary size, which is the qualifying factor for a war strider. The legendary size benchmark to me is, are you as big as an elephant? that size and up is legendary size.
Got it. The legendary attribute means you do not suffer an onslaught penalty?
It has a bunch of rules associated with it, but yeah, onslaught penalties, there's some damage limits, you can't be broken, go into initiative break by someone who isn't backed up by magic. There's a couple of things.
I was just thrilled that I remembered literally anything about the system, Chaz. So, chapter one is entitled Mortals, and almost all of them are mortals, but in some way special. That could be magic, that could be they have an artifact, that could be they know a guy, that could be they have the blessing of a god, or other weird things that Chaz will probably say more about. Or you could be the broker, where you're remarkably generic, and you're like, really? This is what we have. But the first one I wanted to talk about was Bosoku, Prodigal Son of the Swamps. What I found interesting about this character is the Saints of Thuvarayam are a group that obey, we'll talk about this more later, that have this interesting combination of religious activity that depends on following very strict, highly esoteric rules of action and behavior. And one of the things that I find interesting in Exalted, generally a word will be slightly changed from its our world definition. And then I saw Thuvarayam. I'm like, that's actually a thing. And popped it open and shared it with a South Asian friend of mine. She's like, I want an alligator too. So Busoku was going to be kind of the scion of the Quaghead tribe, and then just kind of goes off and lives his own life and feels bad about it in an interesting way. But this figure seems like a very dashing Cajun, has a merit legacy of the Thuvarayam that represents kind of his purported legendary habits. And again, he gets a mount in the form of a giant alligator or crocodile. I don't actually know which. The character write-up, like the stat block, isn't anything to write home about. Almost any Exalt would have absolutely no difficulty with it. But again, he is a crocodile named Chopper. Who doesn't want a crocodile named Chopper? I'm just putting that out there. So what first caught your attention in the Mortals chapter, Chaz?
I also really liked that entry, and I think this is a good point to call out that the organization's chapter, all of the entries tie back to one of the other individual characters that's presented in the earlier chapters. So that's how the Quaghead tribes are connected, is to this prince of theirs. But one of the characters who really stood out to me was Eldren Tebrar, the witch tyrant of Lok. Lok is one of the new cities that showed up on the map in Exalted 3rd Edition that we've had no information about whatsoever up to now. And now we get it in the form of the Witch Tyrant. So it fills in information about the city of Lok itself and presents a mortal character who is also like a full-on campaign boss threat, because Eldren Tebrar is searching for the fragments of a black stone that plunged out of the sky to reassemble it for whatever purpose. And this gives him a whole bunch of charms and artifact abilities that make him a badass. That the stone is represented as an artifact beyond the normal 5-dot limit. And each of the stone's fragments, as he assembles them, gives him additional power. And that makes a mortal character a campaign boss threat, like I talked about. And I think you could have a really interesting campaign arc dealing with Lok, dealing with the artifact, dealing with the witch tyrant. This is a neat story that fits well in Exalted and shows how, with a little bit of magic, even a mortal can challenge the Exalts.
And the thing that struck me about this was an entry that really put together to me what I consider to be one of the issues with trying to figure out Exalted. The set of charms that the Skystone grants to Eldren is an exquisitely designed set of interlocking pieces that are not obvious until you've read through all of them 3 times. Where, oh, he gets this initial boost. By the way, if he takes at least this much damage, it unlocks these 3 things, which you only see if you get to those entries. And then you realize that 2 of them interlock to be like, oh, he's really hard to damage. And if he does damage, he regenerates health very quickly. And there's this narrow window, almost like a boss battle in like a Nintendo game, where you have to hit their carapace 15 times and then they roar up to do their ultimate attack. And briefly then the Ruby Stone of Power is vulnerable that you have to like uppercut twice and then they explode. But if you don't do that, you can never win the boss battle. There was a bunch of that. Additionally, actually destroying the Skystone is done in the form of successive gambits. Chaz, at the table, how do you communicate these gambles? Like, is it something that the characters would have to figure out, or do you just tell them? Like, the first gambit is difficulty 5, and you're trying to crack the Skystone, and then you're trying to shatter it, and then you're trying to blow it up, and they are gambits of increasing difficulty, 5, 7, and 9. How does that get communicated at the table?
So you are supposed to, as a storyteller, call out when there are special scene gambits, things that the characters can do that they wouldn't otherwise know about. That's something that, as ST, you just say, hey, by the way, this is something you could do. In the case of Eldren specifically, I might call for some investigation ahead of time to understand his power or something like that for the characters to figure this out. Or I might drop hints during the scene before I say, by the way, you could do this thing. just to build kind of tension and suspense. Exalted Third Edition, at least, is supposed to be a system where the mechanics are open, meaning that both the storyteller and players have visibility to what is happening at the table. What are the defense numbers? What are the soak numbers? What charms is the opponent using? Those are things that are supposed to be open information, and that applies to gambits as well. This is really neat because Exalted Third Edition has a couple of challenges when you want to present a boss monster. We talked about that in 100 Devils Night Parade, how there was some heavy lifting being done by some of the charms for, like, living architecture to make characters like Sibri or the Living Mance campaign boss enemies. And the charms here for Eldrin do a similar thing, where you can have a singular boss monster enemy go up against your circle. And it's a little bit of like a puzzle box to figure out how do you build a character like that. So this is that done well. And that's where you say it takes a couple of reads to understand how do all of these charms interlock to create that effect. But that is what the Evocations of the Skystone do for Eldrin.
The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting was Eldrin's look. I have him listed as the witch hipster of Locke. And when you mentioned we didn't previously get any information, I picture characters going, "Where's he from?" And he goes, "I'm from Locke. It's kind of obscure. You've probably never heard of it." That was funny specifically to me. It's a hipster
joke. I smiled. I did not get an auditory response, but I did smile.
Okay. The other one that I thought was kind of interesting was Ashana Ikkatu, the master of the Coiled Viper Dojo, first of the Knight's Talons. And this I thought was interesting because, one, it outlines somebody who has kind of gone from place to place, who had some ability with martial arts, and she ultimately challenged and defeated the old master of this particular dojo and took her name as her own, and then found out that the Sifu was blessed from its serpent god founder in accordance with the dojo's traditions. And now this person has kind of mixed their charlatan Montebank background with needing to be the leader of this dojo, and is now using their cleverness and wits to keep it alive and functioning. A character that was possibly going to go into the Immaculate Order and so on. And we get what is a perfectly fine character listing, which is someone who would probably be a dangerous mortal to other mortals. But then we get the special ability, the Serpent Soul, a ethereal serpentine power that dwells within a Saku's soul that, by spending one willpower, can kind of manifest a bunch of these things. And I like this as a general idea that there are mortals that function under the aegis of supernatural powers, and this kind of prevents a group from kind of getting too much beyond their skis. It is also the case that they can summon their dojo, and that creates probably a battle group or something like that, just enough to be bothersome. So spend one willpower to grant a battle group under a command might one if it doesn't already have it. And I like this as an idea. I also like that it kind of wove together what does it look like when someone is going to join the Immaculate Monastery and, like, doesn't. So we get a lot of weird stories of how exalts find their own cryptic place in creation, and I liked seeing that from the mortal side as well, that the same epic stories that the exalts go through, mortals can go through on a smaller scale. And maybe this is a case where now one of your characters is like, oh, this person is just like me, or, oh, this person is dealing with accidentally finding themselves being the head of a group that they didn't want to and doesn't want to do them wrong, but also isn't thrilled that they are now possessing the blessing of a serpent god who wants them to lead this dojo.
There's a couple of things here that I think are interesting as well. I do think Ashana would make an interesting ally for an exalted character if they wanted to pick her up, build that connection to her, or as a foil. Maybe she is the friend of someone else powerful and gets involved in things that the exalted are involved in, but they don't just want to stomp her for whatever reason. It is also the first case where we see a mortal character with exalted martial arts in third edition. This is something that was fairly prevalent in previous edition of the games and was largely pulled out. I think it's a useful thing to do to give mortal characters a little bit of oomph. If you have a mortal character who has exalted martial arts and can use those charms, even with a very limited moat pool, it means that a mortal character can go toe-to-toe with a non-combat exalt. So if you have your social character versus a mortal master martial artist, then you have kind of an interesting contest. I think Ashana is also a character who mechanically would have shown better in previous editions, where I think I've said in previous episodes where we've discussed the power of the exalted has been amplified across the editions as they get things like free excellencies and in-combat moat recovery that are definitely good at the table feel things, but because the rules haven't adjusted the level of power that mortals bring to the table in any way, mechanically, it continues to elevate the exalted past mortal levels. Like I said, having some exalted martial arts brings her up into that a little bit, but she still isn't a challenge even to a starting level combat focused exalt. And I do think that is still a lacking of the system in the current edition.
So were there any other mortals you thought were notable or any other thoughts you had on how mortals were portrayed?
I did think it was interesting that they had to do something to make the character relevant in the exalted sense in each case, and you mentioned that at the beginning. But one other character that I wanted to call out is Renulfer, if I pronounced that even somewhat correctly. He's a sky pirate, and the entry for him is notable in that it includes a half-page sidebar expanding the naval combat rules to include airboat conflict. And so if you wanted to bring your airship combat to Exalted, now there is a little rules module packed into Renulfer's entry to expand the naval combat rules to do just that. I think airships are something that are rare in the setting of creation, but iconic in Exalted games. I think part of that is the Exalted fan base's love of JRPGs and Final Fantasy in particular, where getting the airship is often a big moment in those games. And so the storytellers who run Exalted and the players who play it want to bring that moment to the table and have their airship moment. So I am glad to see rules that help support that.
I was a big fan of this. Suggested to me some things that I had lurking beneath the surface. One is the sheer number of characters in this chapter that have an intimacy of the form, I deserve everything I have, even if it is unearned. So it's good to know that white people exist in Exalted. I was worried there wasn't enough representation there. The other one that I thought was interesting is creation seemingly is largely ruled by scheming grandmothers. Is that true?
It's not untrue.
Okay. There were no fewer than 3 entries where it is like, this is the character. This is their grandson. There were a surprising number of characters throughout this book who were ultimately described as in their late 40s, but in surprisingly good condition. And I'm like, I don't know how I want to feel about that. This was also the suggestion that I don't actually know what intimacies are. The broker has an intimacy of what would you like to know? How is that an intimacy?
I would argue it isn't.
It is good role-playing motivation, and I get that, but a few of them I didn't quite get it. A number of the characters are all listed as handsome, and I do like that Isabet, we finally get a character sheet for a late 20s dandy, which has been one of the impediments I have to running an Exalted game, not having that character sheet at my beck and call.
Isabet is a grandmother character who is a guild factor that has a bunch of interesting stuff going on, but her entry also includes the quick character stats for her sons, who are spoiled dandies, as you mentioned, and they get a full little stat write-up. And that's something that continues through the book, where if there are secondary characters who are key to a particular entry, they also get stats here, which I appreciate. Chapter 2 is Strange Folk, which is kind of the catch-all bucket for other weird stuff in creation. Each of them kind of falls into not quite a unique category, but the familiar categories like the fair folk or characters changed by sorcery or beast folk, or god blooded. So there are some definite categories within this chapter. But Terry, what stood out for you in this chapter?
The entire reason I got this book was revealed to me in chapter 2 when we get Adamantus, the custodian of Utopia. Adamantus is a Raksha Fairfolk character who wants to bring back the city of Bay Minita back. They have charisma 7. Anyone with linguistics 0 does aggravated damage. All of his attacks are in the form of exhortations and stories. He tries to build a cult to slowly turn areas of wherever he is to the utopia of Bay Minita and turn little bits of places into an embodiment of the lost city. Rerolls 5s and 6s because that's sure, just the play with the rules. That's what they're there for. I thought that Adamantus has a compelling story. I think he conveys the weirdness of the fair folk into the setting. I very much like the social attributes as combat attributes thing, which really makes the fact that he has charisma 7 being like, oh, to be kind of an interesting thing. And it goes over what his equivalent escort would be. It is just a dose of weird and a dose of deadly weird. Also, one of the things that we get is we do not do the thing where, oh, Bay Minita is actually terrible and anyone there would be obviously this person's slave, blah, 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 blah. It is a thing where it's like, oh, this is just a kind of a cultural difference. It is a cultural difference that will destroy your culture. But it doesn't normally have the disdain that is dripping seemingly from Raksha entries. It is very much a, you could have things so much better, which I liked. The charms I thought were interesting. I would have to consult them a dozen times before I actually used it. And I feel like this would be heck to use in actual combat where it's like, okay, this person is attacking you by weaving a story about how you failed your parents at a young age and there was a road you didn't travel. How does artifact armor stop that? But it does. Huh. So there are certain narrative questions that I would run into. We also get a brief aside on Wildcraft and how that would work and how he's empowered by an ever-growing cult. Since Adamantus's power grows over time, I really like the idea in a story of having not quite a time bomb enemy, but an antagonist that you know about that isn't quite an emergency, but if you don't deal with them soon, it's going to be a bigger problem later. So I could see this being a character that the circle repeatedly clashes with and kind of matches them toe for toe and gains power as the members of the circle increase in essence, which I like. I found the entry to be of a piece. All the parts fit together.
Yeah, it is an excellent entry. I think it's a good look at the direction that the developers are looking at for the Fair Folk in 3rd edition of making them weird, but not necessarily all weird in the same way. And that the Mirit, Unlettered Bane, where linguistic 0 characters do aggravated damage to him, replaces the usual Fair Folk vulnerability to cold iron. And so gives an example of how you have Fair Folk that care about a particular thing may have some other bane than cold iron. And I think that makes an interesting inclusion in the game for the Fair Folk. It kind of pulls them away from their Euro myth fae roots a little bit more in a way that I think is positive for the setting. When you talk about needing to reference their charms a bunch of times, something that I do when I'm running Exalted for complex adversaries that have a bunch of charms is I kind of write up a little combat plan. And sometimes this is actually done in the entry where it says they use their essence this way, they start with these charms, they combine them in these ways. But just having a cheat sheet of, like, these are the charms that they use in these circumstances can help point you as a storyteller to how to use an antagonist's charms in combat.
That makes sense. I thought you were going to be like, I rename them. And like the Wild Gospel Gathering, I would probably rename Summon Mooks or something like that.
I mean, that kind of reference is actually also helpful, where it's basically your charm quick reference. And this is something I actually work on with players as well. And usually how I do that is I do a quick reference of what does the charm do conceptually. But more importantly, what are the conditions in which it is used? Because a lot of charms are used on a particular type of role in response to a particular type of circumstance. And so if you're scanning your charm list and the first thing says on a decisive attack and you are not making a decisive attack, you do not need to read any further into that charm to decide if you're going to use it or not. So having that condition of use as the first piece of information about a charm in your reference is really helpful.
The other thing that this entry kind of pointed out to me is I feel as if there is a space that I would have liked for lack of a better term, flavorful charms. Like things that may not do something in combat or when we're dealing with trying to do social maneuvers, but things that really evoke the flavor of the character. I feel like those would be helpful. I'm not sure where that would even go, but there were a couple places where I was reading a character reference and I'm like, I'm pretty sure they could do this cool thing that would be very useful in game to convey who or what they are or their level of power without it coming to blows. And that kind of signposting I feel would be useful, but I'm not sure where that would go.
So putting my developer hat on for a second, if I wanted to do that in a game and put it in the written format, I would have like an incidental powers section that has maybe just a bullet list, similar to how there are intimacies that give flavor but don't really work as intimacies. You can have an incidental powers that don't necessarily have a mechanical effect but do convey that flavor. Because one of the challenges running exalted NPCs is that they will always have fewer powers than your players, because you want to focus on the things that are actually going to get seen at the table in the word count. But you could broaden that by giving them incidental magics that, yes, are done with charms, but are not likely charms that are going to be relevant mechanically at the table, but are still interesting to provide the flavor and power of that character.
One of the things I feel like I would constantly run into difficulties with in Exalted is kind of that signposting. It is a game to me where playing it for the first time or running it for the first few times, I would want more ways to indicate to the players the level of hazard any circumstance is.
Yeah, that's fair.
What entry caught your eye in this section?
My favorite entry in this section is Siluris, the Hidden Sting. He is a scorpion man who is fighting against the guild's introduction of slavery and capitalism to his region, and is basically scorpion man Robin Hood fighting against the man. And I just think that's delightfully fun. The scorpion folk entry introduced this whole backstory about how their society was pushed by the lunar who created them. To the point where they said, no, we are not following you any further to our destruction, and build their own little community up in the mountains of the Southwest. And as the outside world is pressing in, they need to protect themselves against that exploitation. And I just think he's a delight.
We also get the merit of Petapalps.
Yes. Where that is probably helpful, it could be used for a lunar character who wants to be a scorpion folk. I do wish that the merit had a cost so that you could use it to build your lunar beast form. But now that I say that, I think that might also appear in the lunar's book. So
I didn't have a second entry that jumped out to me so much as Adamantus did. But like, for instance, in contrast, we get Iolanthe, queen of the Gold Barrel Palace. This was someone who was part of the vanguard during the Great Contagion, who broke the Shogunate's lines and penetrated the Blessed Isle. And now they are kind of ensconced beneath it.
Worth noting that she is also one of the Fair Folk.
Yes, we have the Fair Folk of being a bit more mercurial, of constantly reshaping their domain. And we also get information on the Gold Barrel Palace, where the palace was once a gent lord, a prince among the earth elementals, and she twisted it into this fey thing to be kind of her servant. So there's this glorious mile-wide citadel of crystal in a vast underground cavern that can talk to you and is kind of in the suspended dreamlike state and is constantly kind of being commanded by Iolanthe. So this is much more, to me, that fair folk character who does not care about mortal free will, who just kind of views creation as their plaything. And I thought this was a good comparison. Also has the intimacy of Major herself, Vainglory. I'm like, yes. And again, I'm never never quite sure what to do with that as an intimacy, but again, is a reasonably potent character who has the control of a mile-wide underground domain. So if you ever need to up the threat level to be like, yes, you are more than welcome to fight me in my own house. My house happens to be sentient and under my command. I always feel like that's a good weight thumb to put on the scale for anyone who wants to use the exalted charm of Let's Start Shit. Also, soak of 16.
That is a very solid soak. Yep. In this case, I think the intimacy is more usable than the example you pulled out of the broker, because this is an intimacy where if you are making an argument that puffs her up, you may be able to call on that intimacy to lower her resolve. And similarly, if there is an argument where she has to sacrifice or not be the most important person in the room, she could use it to bolster her resolve. So I think that is one where having a tie to yourself does have concrete ways to come into play.
Got it. And it is appropriately double-sided.
Yes.
There are a bunch of other characters, Lord Lion, who abducts scholars to learn about other places. I thought that was neat. What else struck you, Chaz?
I liked the god-blooded characters in this chapter as a whole. I mean, no one of them really stands out above the others, but Undefeated Granite Warrior, who is the god-blooded crime lord, who is a descendant of an elephant god who fled the Immaculate Order, is interesting. Vien Caral, Shepherd of the Lost, who can find lost stuff and does so to fence it, who is the daughter of a god of lost things, is interesting. I think the characters twisted by sorcery are all interesting. I think there's a lot of interesting characters that fill out the weird of what might show up in creation. This is a good chapter to look at to understand some of the bounds of weirdness within creation.
I was hoping Vien Caral would have been more interesting. The idea of a person that just kind of accumulates lost objects in all of their forms, I thought was interesting. And to some extent, I almost wanted her to be like a Carmen Sandiego character of being very hard to find in creation. But also, I do respect that it's like, yeah, she's a godblood. You figure that would lead to this automatic life of luxury and so on, but it's still hard going. People are either seeking you out to get things or want to use you to get to your father, the god of lost things, and kind of the degree to which do you embrace or do you reject what would be the natural inclination of the abilities that you have been given. So that was one where I'm like, this could have been cooler. Oh no, this makes sense. And I always like when that happens.
Yeah, I think godblooded are one of the character types in the setting where, like, the exalted definitely get wild power that sets them above and apart from the mortal world. But the godblooded have a range of power where some of them can be on that lower level of power with the exalted tier, but some of them just have, like, a few neat tricks that set them above their mortal neighbors, and that puts them in a very interesting place in creation.
How are the godblooded viewed by you, Sean?
It is mixed. It depends on the god. It is technically illegal for the gods to be consorting with mortals, but they all do it, so nobody really gets in trouble for it. It's a bigger issue with the Immaculate Order, where the Immaculate Order will go after gods who flagrantly flout those rules, but the Immaculate Order does not view the sins of the god as necessarily tainting the godblooded, but they have a little bit more to prove, if you will, than someone who doesn't have a background like that, similar to the exigent. So if they behave well with their power, they're accepted within the Immaculate philosophy. If not, they could be deemed anathema. There isn't like one view or one outlook.
So the next chapter is Spirits and the Dead. Chaz, what jumped out at you here?
There was a bunch of interesting stuff in here. I'm actually going to start towards the end of the chapter with Iron Tiger. Iron Tiger is a spirit god, but is the god of a foiled fate, one who sprang into existence to enforce a fate that got broken. And I think this just introduces something delightful to the setting. One of the things that I really like having in the way I present gods in creation is that they spring from all different kinds of stuff. In second edition, there was the idea of least gods, where every object had a god, and sometimes they would get awakened and become more important. That maybe goes a little too far to have every grain of rice have a god, but have some mechanism where things of some level of importance may cause the spontaneous generation of gods and spirits. And Iron Tiger introduces that as a thing for fates. So if there is a fate that is written strongly enough into creation, it may generate a god. And Iron Tiger exists purely to defend the destined prince and ensure his rise to prominence. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, the role of the divine is kind of fascinating. Like, what is the deogenesis, as it were, within the setting? Do we ever get an answer to that? So, like you mentioned, are gods truly spontaneous?
No. So there isn't an answer published for that yet in third edition. The general conversation has been that many of the gods were created directly by the primordials before the Divine Revolution, that gods can get it on and have baby gods just like anybody else. So there are gods who are the children of gods. But then there are lots of example edge cases, like Iron Tiger, who springs from a foiled destiny, or there was the example of, can't remember who it is, but there's a hunt god who basically hunted real good and got to be goddess of the hunt by impressing the other gods. There's Tailspinner, one of the three gods of Great Forks, who basically talked his way into Yushan, of telling stories until he was rewarded with divinity so that he could keep telling his stories immortally. So there are definitely other sources of gods. It's also stated in the core book that a sorcerer can turn someone, can change the nature of a spirit between spirit types. So like they could turn a demon into a god, severing them from their Malfian prison and changing their essence. So there are definitely other sources of gods, but there isn't really an answer to it. So putting on my fan hat totally and not as an exalted writer, one of the ideas that I like is that in the making of creation, the primordials built arcane mechanisms that cause the generation of gods when certain conditions are met, but that they are so esoteric that nobody in creation has really figured out what those are, even the gods themselves. And so sometimes gods just spring into being and you've got to do something with it. But it's not the profusion of gods that existed in second edition with the least gods.
Got it. So we don't yet have evidence that there are yokai.
Correct.
While we're talking about gods, I wanted Siakal to look more menacing.
That is fair. Who is Siakal, and what do you like about her?
Siakal is the Western god of battle, slaughter, and sharks. And we have had the conversation before where gods are not the thing that they embody. Plentamon himself is not luck, but the gods do generally enjoy their work. Siakal takes offerings in the form of generally ships that have been seized, and then her sharks are summoned, just these absolute massive, pants-shittingly large, at least to me, sharks that can be 20 yards long. And if the sacrifice is not deemed to be worthy for what was summoned, the summoned sharks will also just devour the summoners. And from what I understand, each direction has a god of battle, but it is interesting to be the god of battle and of slaughter. Like, that is, that really shapes the view. This is not the god of just and worthy competition. This is not the god of, oh, you almost got it. This is the god of the rout. This is the god of the disorderly retreat. This is the god of the field strewn with blood, or in this case, waves tinged with crimson. And she is menacing, cool, and aloof as one anticipates, and has a big coral sword. But yeah, I really thought we were going to get something a little more menacing, and that's me on that.
By more menacing, you're talking about the art, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the description of her of being a shark-skinned woman with a wide shark shark mouth and flat black eyes didn't quite carry across to the art. And I'm not sure quite what's up with her outfit. I'd like her to be regaled a little bit more as a warrior in some way. I mean, all of the war gods are pretty great. I think they're just generally well done. And it's fun to see Siakal in here.
What is the relationship between the gods of the same thing in different areas? Like, what is it? Al-Hot is the god, the eastern or southern god of war also?
Southern god of war. Sunipa is the eastern god of war. I cannot remember who's the northern god of war off the top of my head, or the central god of war.
Do they have like a trade union like the American Mango Council?
So they are all part of the same division in the Bureau of Humanity in Heaven. So they are in theory co-equal offices in their bureau. So they work together. They're colleagues.
So is this one of those cases where they're co-equal, but some people are more co-equal than others?
Yeah, it depends. It comes down to office politics at that point.
Got it. So at minimum, there is probably something like a grudging respect, hopefully.
Yep.
And then it's interesting because, like, immediately in contrast, we have Ninigala, who is just dripping with style.
Yeah.
You have a merit. What's the merit? You have all the artifacts. Oh, that's a merit. But yep. Yeah, so two shorter ones. What else struck you in the chapter?
I am a fan of the gods in general. I am kind of a fan of Ixir, who is a spirit generated from the dreams of a town victimized by one of the fair folk, and has intimacies like the dreams of the dead live on in me, and I will finish that which was left undone, and hates the Raksha, and is just this weird spirit. So again, coming up with a different generative story for where a spirit or god comes from. So I like that one. But then one of the other ones that I thought was just a lot of fun was Javena Orea, who is a ghost, but also a ghost ship. So she's the ghost of a drowned bride. And her entry includes having a ghost ship that hunts other ships, giving you kind of that classic ghost ship story. I do wish her entry had a little bit more word count to give her more story hook in her background. The author for this entry actually reached out to me on social media and was like, yeah, I wish I had that too. Here are some ideas that I had. And they just couldn't fit due to word count because we wanted to get the ghost ship in there. And that I think is actually also worth calling out. There are some of these entries that have a really hard balance of word count because they wanted each entry to be two pages with a couple of exceptions that get four pages or get to break out of that two-page format. Some of them do feel a little bit spare, where either the stats don't fill in what the character really should have to be usable at the table, or the story gets short shrift in order to offer those stats. And so I think that was definitely a hard balance to hit with all of the entries in the book. And I wish in some cases they had been able to be more flexible in how those entries got put in there.
In addition to gods in this section, we had spirits and ghosts and a few other things. And of those, Telemedes the Eveler Vigilant was probably my favorite, a ghost that stalks the southern dunes on an ancient patrolman circuit and is kind of presented as a ghost that doesn't have anything particular to guard except for kind of this philosophy about the strong and the weak. And it is basically this philosophy of perpetual adversity, that the weak must become the strong must protect the weak, and we all must strive. It finds weird embodiments. For instance, it is indicated that Telemedes once prevented a bunch of bandits from looting a city, but then burned down the fields of the village. And I'm like, uh-huh. Wound penalties are instead treated as bonuses to parry and resolve. And it is interesting just to see a spirit that is clinging to a philosophy more so than anything else, and is always in it to kind of push people. And I mean, that is kind of one of the ideas we get behind the Dragonblooded in certain places, like let's push everyone and see if we can get them to exalt or strive to great success or burn out. And it is interesting seeing a different view of that embodied kind of in one entity. Chaz, what of the other entries jumped out at you.
Oh boy, before we leave this chapter, we must talk about one of the ones that I think was a top favorite for both of us. In the section of elementals, we get Unrelenting Aton, the Last Mountain. Terry, what is so delightful about this character?
There's a couple ways to take it. Guy hasn't stood up in a couple centuries. Let's just start there. Has accumulated a pretty impressive cult about himself, but believes that creation is headed towards an apocalypse. Has seen the fall of the shogunate, has seen the great contagion, has seen the shattering of the solar deliberative, has seen the vanishing of the Scarlet Empress, and is like, oh, dip. And the single most evocative line in this entire book as he keeps a list of everything he believes could end the world. Show me that list! Because, like, legitimately, it probably includes things like the Death Lords, the return of Odokthon, one of the return of the Third Circle demons, or something like that, an invasion for the Rakshasa. But also, there's probably an entry on the list that there's this little old lady in this town outside of Lukshai that has a marble that actually contains, that is actually like Exalted's version of nuclear weapons like that. And also there's probably, as happens with anyone that is a conspiracy theorist, one of the entries is probably like milkweed. And you're like, what? And he's like, oh no, got to keep an eye on milkweed. He has the ability to grant a blessing that turns people into stone, where they become stronger and stronger and stronger and slower and slower and slower until they become frozen pillars of stone that only with great sorcery can they briefly gain the ability to act again. So it is this, I don't want to say reverse martyrdom, but very slow martyrdom that I thought was interesting. The fact that he hasn't moved means that he needs an intelligence network to do. So that could be something that is a thing that could take place for interesting politicking or playing around. We later find out that this network of apocalypticists is throughout creation. It's not just kind of in one area. What did you like about Aton?
He's an earth elemental prepper cult leader. I find that entertaining. The elemental court, where he is supposed to be like managing the earthquakes for this region, really just wants him to come back and do his job. they don't want you to hurt him. They don't want you to like take him down a peg. They just want him to come back and do his job. Is an entertaining juxtaposition.
You haven't reported to work in 752 years. We're going to need to talk about that. Any thoughts before we move on to talk about the exalts?
Yeah, Wong Pongrok is one of the elemental dragons, a censor of the south. There are a couple of things about this entry that left me a little bit disappointed. One, this is one where clearly the balance of word count between story and rules was impossible. And so they don't have the room for the longer, wider story that this character had in previous editions of why this dragon believes that his corruption is okay. And basically it comes down to his boss went missing, and so he is censor in all but name, and that irks him. He believes that since he hasn't been recognized for this promotion, even though he's doing the work, he deserves to enrich himself and his allies. And then there's just a whole bunch of story about like his boss and everything going on in the South and the spirit courts of the South that I think is fun that didn't get to show up here. This is one where I am not happy with the art, either his human form or his dragon form. This is one where I am glad that he's here because it's nice to get another elemental dragon, another censor, but I wanted more out of this entry.
Yeah, and the immediately next entry is Zemedea, the lesser elemental dragon of wood, the toadstool stage, who is a character that is looking for a panacea, a cure to all things in the wake of the great contagion, and in the process of doing that has created untold death as part of her research. And as a mage player, how far are we willing to go to do the good thing? Really resonates with me as a theme. And while that does come up in Exalted, I thought this was a very good example of that. Even to the point where her shaping ritual gains 5 sorcerer's motes whenever a spore-infected character or battle group dies or loses a point of size within short range. And this only lasts until the end of the day. So this is a case where for her to use her magic, you're like, oh, even to fuel her magic requires this immense amount of death. But to her mind, she is still looking to the source of all diseases. It kind of feels like the exalted version of gain of function research, where you're like, oh, so you want to cure cancer by making it airborne and contagious. That doesn't make sense, science. So, I also like that this seemingly felt like one of the few cases where we had a character whose art was heavily defined by themes of indigeneity, just in terms of affect, color palette, and style. And I like the idea of seemingly a native-looking character with a dragon in the scene holding up a test tube. I think that is a good single-frame summary of what makes Exalted fascinating and what we probably need more of in our RPGs.
I think this is a case where it's supposed to be her dragon form and her human form. In the same piece of art, which is very cool.
So, shall we talk about exalts?
Yeah, let's talk about exalts.
Chaz, what's an exalt? No.
Well, Terry.
How was this chapter organized, and what was the first exalt that jumped out at you?
So, this chapter is organized by exalt type, which seems like a reasonable way to organize a chapter like this. Not every type of exalt that exists appears in this chapter, but we do get a pretty good wide spread. And notably, many of these entries came out, for example, like the Lunars came out before the Lunar book did. So they offered kind of a preview of how those exalts worked. The same is true of the sidereals and abyssals and liminals in here. But the first one that jumped out to me is actually one of the solars, because I think solars as antagonists are often hard to come up with.
Boring!
And I really enjoyed the presentation of Harrowing Silence, because this is a character driven by paranoia who is protecting her people, but doing so to excess by cutting them off from the outside world and murdering anybody who shows up. And I think this is a great character where you can point at them and say, yeah, maybe we do need the Wild Hunt to intervene here. So you could play a dragon-blooded game where you are the Wild Hunt coming after this character and have an interesting story. Alternatively, you could play a circle of exalts trying to foil the Wild Hunt and needing to deal with this character's paranoia, where she's going to come after you. And like, how do you then balance dealing with this solar who is a problem while the Wild Hunt is after her and then after you because you've put yourself in the way? So I think there's just a lot that you can do with this character to generate story.
I would like to note that this is the first time in Exalted where there were two Dragonblooded in a row that I found interesting. The first was Gleaming Nice, who is a character who dreamed of an abandoned city, pursued it with all of her sorcerer's might, found it, and discovered Glacier's Edge, which is an ancient machine that wishes to be set free. Every time people are like, hey, Terry, your version of Exalted is too weird, I'm going to have this on a poster and just point to it. Because this is the stuff I came for. What is the machine? What is it doing? What does it mean for a machine to dream? Just this person who has that obsessive pull and is trying to balance the needs of being a dragon-blooded with also the fact that you have this ancient machine that is whispering to you darkly. And it doesn't say what Glacier's Edge is. I very much like that. I think that is story upon flavor. And then the immediate entry after that of Regara Feria, the Admiral of the Imperial Air Fleet. There is a scene in Promising Young Woman where Carey Mulligan spits in Bo Burnham's coffee, and while maintaining eye contact, he drinks it. I think that is the relationship I would have with Regara Feria. This is a person who doesn't take shit from everyone and looks great doing it.
I think it is important to note that when they say the Imperial Air Fleet, they mean the Fleet of the North, which is the direction of air.
Yes.
Regular ships, not
airships. It took me a while to figure that out.
But yes.
No, but this very much was an interesting character to me because they are of one house, they are servicing to another. I mean, their intimacies, they have House Pelops respect and House Regara obligation. And I think this did a good job of elucidating the difficulty of being a dragon-blooded member who has a strong obligation to their house, but also a keen sense of duty and is doing well with it. Also has a Reaper Dyclave, and it's always nice to have a sword.
Yep. I also like this entry. I think she does a really good job of highlighting the kind of split loyalties that are going to exist in the Dragonblooded Civil War. A character like this is someone who could shift the tide of battle by swaying what her fleet does. So if you are rooting for either House Rhaegara or House Pelops, I could see an interesting series of like social interactions with her to get her to act or not act in a particular way with the fleet. And so that, yeah, I think that is a really interesting one.
Also, her crew is magnitude 7. That's just a number we don't see for magnitude that often, which is, I understand, different than size, but still.
One of the other exalts I liked was in the exigence section. The exigents in general, I thought, were a lot of fun. But the one who I wanted to call out is Kualebri Jinhua, who is the exigent of the god of secret arsenals, an artifact god, essentially. And she is a weaponsmith for hire. She is the character in the frog mech that we see on the cover, and she will make war artifacts for the highest bidder, which has estranged her from her god. And I just think this is an interesting character. She comes with a Warstrider, so we get another Warstrider entry here, which is always a lot of fun. And I like this entry.
I, to the surprise of no one, I very much enjoyed sidereal entries. We've got a third edition write-up for Iron Siaka, noted slayer of the hearts of field hockey teams throughout creation. We also got a write-up for Scheherazade, which I assume is a play on Scheherazade, in that she also has a book that tells stories. It is interesting to see Iron Siaka as the battle-ready servant of the Maiden of Serenity, and Scheherazade as the gracious, beautiful servant of the Maiden of Battles. I like that juxtaposition. It reminds you that stereotypes in Exalted are very weak, and it is a setting that is very comfortable playing around with trope without necessarily lampshading it, without going, look what we're doing! Look at us! And it is hard to do that. I like that everyone has a Gormal. I don't know what that is, but I'm glad. I do like that we get the story behind Iron Siaka's mace. It is made of a bit of meteor that was a star that was pulled from the sky to stop a tidal wave during the Primordial War. We get relatively few charms, but both of them are character write-ups that are kind of dripping with flavor. And as sidereals, I frequently view them as characters that if you're fighting them, something has gone wrong. But I think we have enough of everything else that you would be able to fill that out.
I do want to make another art call out in that Scheherazade is making the very poor choice of wearing a chainmail halter top over apparently nothing, which sounds uncomfortable.
Ox body technique, just for your notes.
Yes. Yes.
I appreciate that we got, I think, the single most flavorful Exalted charm I think I've ever experienced per unit word. Like, there are ones that are more flavorful, but the Bleeding Lily Crowned in Shackles, Queen of the Onyx Kingdom. One, I think as a character is fascinating, someone who journeyed into the underworld and realized that there was a kingdom that needed to be protected. And it gave us that view of the very noble abyssal, which I like as an archetype. But also she has a charm where if you lie to her, you bleed from your eyes. And I'm like, uh-huh. I am now much more interested in abyssals. And then on the other end, we get the Prince Resplendent in the Ruin of Ages, who is someone who just kind of goes around creation trying to find these ancient troves and is kind of an abyssal warrior artiste, which I think is interesting and flavorful and to me is kind of an interesting contrast to Three Winters, who is a sidereal who goes around documenting tombs. So it's like, yep, one over here. We should probably keep everyone away from that. The other thing that I had difficulty with this chapter was Withering Vine, who is one of the liminals. I don't feel I had enough information to actually run with that. I don't feel it necessarily gave me an idea of what a liminal would be like. So that is just one of those things where it's kind of interesting. I would probably have to change this character into something else, not an exalt, to use them in a game, but that just may be my shortcomings as someone who is not thoroughly familiar with the setting.
I think this is a case where liminals are probably one of the loosest defined exalt types in terms of their place in the setting. And so maybe with the context of the liminal book, this will make more sense. But we'll have to see when that happens.
What did you think of the weaponized exigence of Braze the Accursed?
I thought it was an interesting idea. I liked that the introduction of that to the setting, how sometimes exaltation is not a blessing. And the fact that Braze betrayed the god for whom he was high priest and lover, and then got cursed with her by exigence. It was a very interesting story beat.
That is a god-tier fuck you, by the way. Like
literally.
Yes. It works on multiple levels.
Let's move into organizations. And organizations, the opening fiction is the Cult of Aton working on a plot, which again, just nice to come back to them. But Terry, what did you think of the organizations presented here?
I loved them. This was great. It brought the setting together. It gave me an idea of what can occupy the time of mortals besides being turd farmers. It highlighted the weird corners that at local levels, you can stumble upon something that is super weird to you, but everyone's like, oh yeah, this is just a group that's in the area. They've been here for centuries. They run a food drive. They also think that the end is nigh. But yeah, they also do after-school programs for kids. It is one of the most real chapters in that like stuff like that happens in real life all the time. Where it's like, oh, you live in the shadow of an active volcano. Yeah, it's a living. And you're like, you do that willingly? Like, yeah, my dad grew up here. I want to stay near my family. So it is both weird and remarkably human in a way that I very much appreciate. For instance, I mentioned how much I like the character Busoku, and it gives us information about the Quaghead tribe, the crocodile folk in the swamps of the Riverlands. We get information on the Garahags, who are kind of their priestly caste, but it is highly legalistic, that each gang will have rules that include things like never attack a group that contains a dancer, or always engage in combat against a riverboat that uses wood of this particular tree. I very much enjoy the combination of naturalism and legalism to create this kind of esoteric religion. And the fact that the characters are viewed as outlaws, they don't view themselves as outlaws. They are just obeying a higher order law. There is also a region that they cannot go to because they do not know the rules there. I don't know if that is supposed to be a specific reference to the construction of the simple of the second temple, but if it is, chef's kiss. That's the kind of stuff that I think Exalted does amazingly well.
I like the presentation of religion in this chapter. Religion in the Exalted fan base is often seen as transactional. Mortals worship gods to get the gods' blessings. But this chapter presents organizations that construct religion within the setting of Exalted in a way that makes sense, because faith, for the most part, is not transactional. And like, people are still people and believe things. And the gods are supposed to remain apart from mortals. So even when you do know that the gods exist, what exactly they want and what that means in a greater sense is not something that is commonly known to the inhabitants of creation. And the examples here highlight that. The one that I wanted to call out is the Darianites of Yain, who are also called the Children of Green and Gold. They are almost a protest cult to the Immaculate Order, where they they trace this cult back to Darian Nightbreaker, a solar anathema who battled against the realm in its early years. But in hearing the Immaculate Order describe the Solar Exalted as demons, and understanding that the Solar Exalted are in some way connected to the sun, they've conflated this with how in Malphys there is the green sun, and so they worship both creation's unconquered sun and Hell's green sun as a brother of the unconquered sun, who in the beginning of time chained the elemental dragons. Both demons and solars alike are champions against the hated dragon-blooded and the false cult of the Immaculate Order. And just having this wild misunderstanding that from the outside we see, oh no, this is very wrong, but from in setting makes a lot of sense when all you've heard are the beliefs of the Immaculate Order and you reject that outright. Like, this is a religious construct, makes sense. And I just think it's great, great fun in presentation, because this is a cult that, as say Solar Exalted, they are going to flock to you and are going to do things for you, but they will also expect things of you. And then they have this wild other set of expectations around demons and the place of demons. They will summon demons. One of their practices is that the cult leaders, when they reach the end of their lives, will summon Alvuvewa of the Nightforge, the demon who can turn willing people into artifacts. And so they turn themselves into artifacts for the cult's use. And just like there's a bunch here that is, I just think makes for a really interesting religion in creation's context.
I also like the fact that it mentions that this is very much a subversive cult, in that like you're like, oh, they're radically wrong. So is the Immaculate Order. Like, Cropchop Carjack and a bunch of his friends came up with it to keep creation under wraps. It's interesting to be like, the truth that opposes the false truth does not mean that it's true. I like also that they are spread through signs and sigils, that they take advantage of the underclass. And I think it is a fascinating discourse on the power of religion as a tool of persistence and subversion, power of a belief movement to slowly subvert something else. I also like the idea of this causing infernal and solar meet cute that we all know that we wanted, where the cult's like, okay, you serve the same boss. You should be friends. And they're just like, there has been a misunderstanding. it just dripping with ideas and flavors. And ideas and flavor, it's not like a rotisserie chicken. I also like the green and yellow color palette. Real subversive, because to me as an old Marvel fan, that always meant the bad guy, because the good guys got the primary colors. I particularly enjoyed the Children of the Weaver. At one point in creation, a pattern spider was knocked from heaven during the contagion, and it was nursed back to health by mortals. Later, it created its own brood, and they created their own little loom of fate for their village. And now there are Children of the Weaver, which are kind of these, I don't want to say robotic, but like obviously kind of metallic people wandering around. And the locals are good to them, and in exchange they get blessings, and the Children of the Weaver have the ability to understand and twing the strings of this local fate. They have the ability to sense someone's history, and again, this is another one of those cases of, yeah, it might be weird to everyone else, but if you grow up like this, you're kind of used to it. It makes mention that this interfaces with the actual Loom of Fate. They do not have the same skill as the pattern spiders within the Dome of Heaven. So sometimes there are mistakes, and one of the things they have to do is keep this on the down low, otherwise the sidereals will notice. And like what the celestial bureaucracy would do if they're like, oh, another Loom of Fate, can't have that happen. I thought it was interesting and neat and showed a side of how people just kind of manage. And I think that is an important theme in any game that is going to have like normal people in it.
Yeah, definitely. There were another one that I liked, and I was like, oh yeah, Terry's going to pick this for his list to talk about.
And I like the fact that it didn't play up the trope of them being like robots. They were just kind of different. And it also brings up a lot of questions of fate and destiny. As I constantly say, Exalted is a setting about large, interesting, fascinating existential questions, and it refuses violently to answer all of them. So getting a little bit of a peek in there, I thought was interesting. And I like the fact that it is a mutual relationship. It is not a town that is subjugated by this minor corn god that everyone has to show abeyance towards. It's like, no, it's everyone gets something out of this, which I like. Any other groups stick out to you?
Nope. Are we ready to move to final thoughts?
We are ready to move to final thoughts. If you want more information on the Cult of Atone, we got that here too. Chaz, what did you think about it overall?
I thought this was a really good entry, and the points where it suffers are almost all by the tyranny of word count. Places where either there wasn't enough room to expand the story that would really make a character shine, or there wasn't enough room to provide the rules to make a character fully useful. I think there are very few entries in this book where I couldn't hang at least a short story on them in an Exalted game. I think it does a great job of expanding out the setting in the little pockets where the characters are presented. And I think there's a lot of interesting extras. We get artifacts, we get the sky combat rules, we get the organizations that I was not expecting to appear in this book when the collection first started. And I just think it overall is a really solid entry in expanding an understanding of the vision of the developers of the game, of the kinds of stories that Exalted should tell. And that was a very tormented sentence, but I think I got my point across.
For me, if I were to level a criticism, it would kind of be in three parts. One, in a bunch of cases, the art did not match the description. Mazian was half jade rather than having a jade face mask that is listed. I just didn't know what some of the charms did. Like, in some cases, we got spells or evocations that didn't actually do anything. Like, we didn't get a system with it. One of them was for Linthin Gugianga, has a charm Bell Snake Bite. And I'm like, okay. What's a bell snake? A bunch of cases in the book, I didn't know if something was a tie into something bigger and exalted or just a throwaway reference. That is due to my lack of encyclopedic familiarity. We already talked about the problem with some of the intimacies. One of the things that happens in anthologies is, one, you often won't have a consistent voice. Two, you run into places where if Chaz goes, I want to write something that Exalted doesn't have, and I say, I want to write something that Exalted doesn't have, and then five other people do the same thing, we could wind up getting six out of those seven entries inadvertently being remarkably redundant as we all try and fill in the same blank space. This book is full of people that are listed as, I survived adversity, okay. We get a lot of middle-aged women who are still attractive, and it is specifically said in words like that, which made me go, ugh. Like, I see what you're trying to do, but you all tried to do the same thing at the same time. There's a weird line between this and 100 Devil's Night Parade. Like, there's a bunch of entries I think you could have easily moved between the two. At the end of the day, to some extent, who cares?
To that, I have a follow-up. I know when the decision to make these books came about, they said, we're going to do a character book and a monster book. I think that was kind of to the detriment of both, because yeah, many monsters in Exalted are also full characters. And many of the characters in here really don't need a full character sheet. I think they would serve the storyteller better with quick character stats. It's one of those early, we're going to do it this way decisions that I think did end up being a detriment. And I have a hard time holding it against the final book that we got. But I do wish that we had gotten them all as quick characters, because it just makes running the game easier.
We get legendary size listed in a couple of places. So it's just one of those things where, like, yes, this entry, and this entry, I'll call upon it. I can't complain. But otherwise, it was good. As someone who is not intimately familiar with the setting, I thought it made creation much more interesting and flavorful. I thought it was interesting that there were exalt types we just didn't get any entries for, but we'll get those eventually in other places. Additionally, this book gave me 11 words that I had not known. And it is, I'm not going to say it's exceedingly rare, but it is not common for an RPG book to introduce a new word to me. And in this case, there were 11. Chaz, do you know the definitions for any of the following words? Montebank, cabochon, cataphract, inanition, infrangible, akator, curious, kohler, byssus, espial, or proselyte?
I know cataphract.
Okay.
Sure. I may be able to figure out some of the others in context.
I am constantly floored by Exalted's ability to be like, oh, you thought you did well in the SAT English portion? Well, try again, sucker. So Exalted, it keeps me humble.
Just working off of that, it is incumbent on Exalted authors to find words like that often. It is a product of needing to name charms and just the sheer number of charms that need names, that need to use different words for similar things, because they're in the same thought space, even if they do slightly different things mechanically, and you don't want them to all have the same words in the charm titles. So I think that is a big part of what drives Exalted's vocabulariness.
I will note, I specifically had two rules. One, it could not be a charm or a place name. Two, it could not be a description of a piece of equipment.
Okay.
So those were 11 words that were not in charm titles. If I included that, it would have increased yet further. But I think also that kind of expansive vocabulary is useful to create a sense of other, a different place. Like, Exalted uses a lot of ancient Roman terms because they're not in common parlance anymore. I don't think Exalted would nearly be as rich if satrapies were known as states or provinces. Satrap is good. So, yeah.
It's a great word.
So what are we reading next, Jazz?
I don't know. That's a great question.
Well, Chaz, I look forward to next again when we get to talk book.
Yes, definitely. Until then, RPG strong.
I also want to make a joke about Iron Siaka coming to know entire field hockey teams, but I don't know if field hockey exists within the world of creation, so that may not be appropriate.
I don't think it's impossible for field hockey to exist in creation. It seems like a reasonable sport that exists somewhere. I don't think creation is as surreal as you want it to be.
I know it's not, Chaz. And you know I know. And we both know that's not going to stop me.
Still, it had to be said.
Which is why I like Zoom. But let me...
Do you want to do this on Zoom instead?
No, because then we'd be on Zoom. To quote my friend Chaz Kellner, that was amusing. Did you smile at the bird running from the explosions that I sent you?
I did, yes. It's also not how anatomy works, looking at those hips and that foreshortening, and that there's a lot going on there that I have questions about, even with my very limited artistic talent.
Yeah, you and I are both at the level where we're like, and the no is like, it's wrong for these five reasons. We're like, yay, no.
There's something very clearly wrong with his hips.
Yes. Alternatively, he is actually a sentient crab or something like that. So a few things that I've ever done in my life made me feel stronger than doing the Savoy rollout, where we just take all of the stuff that we built backstage and we bring it to the performing venue to set up. And it was like me and a whole bunch of 60 and 70 year old retired white collared workers. So they're like, oh my God, Terry, how are you lifting that 15-pound object all by yourself? I'm like, behold how strong I am. I shall lift two, one with each hand. And the guy in charge is like, Terry, I appreciate your gusto, but you're giving other people the belief that they can do more than they can, and they're starting to injure themselves. So for health and safety reasons, I was told to slow my roll. I was just like that perfect amount of sore. And then the next day I sneezed. I sneezed very violently, and I've been recovering from that sneeze for the past 13 days.